Behavioral Health Today, a podcast by Triad Behavioral Health, covering trending topics in behavioral and mental health. This podcast is designed to share unique and relevant topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a mental health perspective. Due to the sensitive nature of today's topic, discretion is advised for younger listeners.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor, and I'm joined today by Jessica Munoz and Tammy Patanga. Jessica Munoz is a practicing clinical nurse practitioner in Hawaii and the founder and president of Ho'ola Napua. And Tammy Patanga is a community outreach coordinator at their program. Tammy is also a survivor herself who has risen out of her circumstances of early childhood abuse. Ho'ola Napua is a nonprofit organization in Hawaii that's committed to the prevention of child sex trafficking and providing care for children who've been exploited. Through their program, Jessica and Tammy have emphasized long-term aftercare for underage trafficking victims through collaborative, trauma-informed systems and victim-centered approaches. Both Jessica and Tammy have been leaders in the development of the anti-trafficking movement in the Hawaiian Islands. Ladies, thank you so much for being here with us today on Behavioral Health.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Great to be with you. You know, I'm excited. This is the first of a three-part series addressing sex trafficking and the work being done by Ho'ola Napua. Jessica and Tammy, today we're going to be talking about your organization, kind of setting a foundation for this three-part series, and its advocacy, awareness raising, and the prevention of child sex trafficking. So as we start out, what I'd like to ask, Jessica, if you could start us out just by telling us about this crisis of child sex human trafficking, as well as its impact and its increased impact actually during this global pandemic.
Yeah, so I've been doing this work for about 11 years now, and I got started just through my day job. I was working at one of our local hospitals, and I started seeing our local kids, American children, coming into the emergency room. And, you know, all my background's in child abuse, sex assault, domestic violence, and yet I didn't know that American children were being bought and sold on a daily basis. And it's been going on not just in the last 10 years, it's been going on for generations. And so in recognizing that there was something not right with a lot of these cases I was seeing, I started making calls to our local juvenile justice and child welfare systems, along with local police. And there was not a great awareness of the issue. And so what I knew was a crisis on our hands, really over the last 11 years, has unfolded to show the actual depth and breadth of what's happening here and what's happening across our country. So most people, you know, they think of trafficking and they think of the movie Taken. They think of kidnapping. Yes. They think of vans and chains and cages and international travel. But the reality is that it doesn't take that. And kids are being exploited in their own homes. They're often bought and sold by family members. They could be exploited by a boyfriend. You know, 90% of trafficking is really a boyfriend relationship. Huh. It's not that kidnapping and being taken from your family. And so I think the misperceptions around what this actually looks like, especially in America, has really started to finally unfold.
It's happening, you know, right there in front of us.
Right, exactly. And there's about 100,000 kids that are newly trafficked every year in the United States. We can all think about what's happened in the last several months with the whole Epstein case that has come forward, right? People have this greater awareness that it is the level of exploitation that's taking place and who is buying and who is selling our kids. And the awareness has increased significantly, because when I first started, it was like I was met with a lot of blank stares, like, well, we don't have this problem. And what are you talking about? And so I think the more we're understanding the way it presents, what it looks like, the fact that it's not just kidnappings and being taken to another country, but that in fact, it's exploitation can be happening in your own home from a bedroom to a bedroom. You know, it really knows no boundaries. It knows no socioeconomic barriers. We've worked with kids who lived in Section 8 housing to kids who've gone to private school.
Yeah. So you're kind of expanding, not just understanding of it, but maybe breaking some myths too, that it's not kind of this international espionage where the things like we see in the movie Taken, it's right there in front of us a lot of times. It's maybe even next door, or maybe even in our family. We may not even know it.
Exactly. And I think that that's why it's been allowed to hide for so long, and what we say, live in the darkness, you know. Ho'olenapua means new life for our children, and it was founded on the premise of shining the light in the darkness and watching new life come forward and bringing up stuff that has so much shame and stigma around it. But that's what has kept so many survivors in the darkness and not allowed to come forward and share their story and share what's been going on, because a lot of times it does have family ties and, you know, there's shame with that.
This whole series that we're doing is happening within the context of a COVID virus where we're shut down for about 4 or 5 months now, going on 6, I believe. What's been the impact of this global pandemic on the sex trafficking?
So across the country and around the globe, COVID has not stopped traffickers from trafficking individuals. Our kids are busier than they've been. We've definitely not seen a decline in trafficking. And I think as the world economy worsens over this pandemic, it's going to just increase the amount of exploitation and trafficking. I know, Tam, do you want to weigh in a little bit on what we're seeing with the kids? Tammy does all our direct service.
I'd love to hear that.
Yeah.
Sure. So a lot of the youth that I work with, they have gone on the run during this pandemic time, because as we know, if you're confined in an environment where, you know, there's abuse or things are lacking, you're going to leave that situation. And what happens is they become vulnerable, right? When they're out there on the run, they become vulnerable. So even if they were in foster care, if they were at their own home, or if they were in a drug treatment placement or whatever the placement might have been, the fact that they have been confined, they are like frustrated. They're like, I'm done, I'm out of here. And they go on the run. So we have seen an increase in them leaving care, like in-service care. And so we do see them coming into the emergency rooms. We see them having tremendous amount of more trauma on trauma. So they've already been identified as a victim. They've already been having symptoms of mental health needs, and they're not in care. So the exploiters are taking advantage of the fact that they're out there, and they're enticing them and getting them involved in the game.
You know, I know that there are, outside of the COVID virus, there are a good number of children that we all know grow up in dysfunctional families, using that kind of as an umbrella term. Alcohol, substance abuse, drug abuse, abuse whether it's verbal, physical, sexual, homes where, you know, there's constant contention and conflict within the parental unit, and homes within which, you know, they're just not seen, or their parents are not available for them in necessary ways as they're growing. And I know that these children are particularly vulnerable just in general for exploitation. But I understand too, and I've seen it, you know, in my work, that with this lockdown and with a mandatory isolation, this is a pressure cooker in the homes. Just unbelievable pressures going on in the homes at all ranges. Like you said, you know, the socioeconomic piece, because the tensions become great. And I can see where the kids would want to get out of this environment where it's just so painful, so difficult, and they've got to be living, a lot of them, in such great fear. Tammy, can you give us kind of an awareness, or a greater awareness, of the process that can develop for a child, young adult, that can result in them being brought into this sex trafficking world? What does that process of that evolution tend to go, may I ask?
Sure. So how it happened for me, and I'm sure it's a great deal of the ways that children experience trafficking today. It's not like my happy story or anything like that. I just want people to be aware that there's always a fine balance. It takes work. I put in a lot of work on my recovery, and it's been a lot of years, but I will take it back to when I was a child and how it happened for me. So I've been Hanai'd, which is like adoption with no papers. My mom abandoned me when I was 3 months old, and my dad took me in and raised me, but I was with different family members throughout my early childhood. And then he got married when I was 6. And so then I had a mom. But from 4 to 13, there was sexual abuse by my family member. That was my dad. And when you're 4 years old, you don't really know what that abuse is until you realize, like, oh, my friends' dads don't do that to them. Like, nobody's talking about this. Why am I so weird? And then there was some physical abuse and some emotional abuse as well. So by the time I was 13, I finally told my sister, my older sister, and she brought in CPS. At the time, it was Child Protective Services. And they took me out. They put me in foster care. I had to do the whole thing, you know, just talking about it again and again and again. I just remember feeling like it was my fault, like something I did was wrong. So I finally got placed into a long-term foster home. And I was okay, but I wasn't. I smoked a lot of weed. I learned how to do cocaine at that time. Mm-hmm. I started to drink alcohol excessively. And I also had sexual encounters with many different people. And so a girl came into our foster home one day and she was talking about how she had this pimp and how she was working the streets of Waikiki. And now mind you, this is in the 70s and the pimp and hoe culture was popping at that time and it was very popular. And then I met a bunch of guys in Waikiki and I went home with this dude. And very shortly, I was on the track in Waikiki working for him, making money and learning how to do all the things that you do when you're in the game. And then eventually I went to Alaska and I worked in an escort service. And we know that trafficking doesn't mean that you go across state lines, but in my case it did. Then I escaped from him. It was horrible. Like the life that I lived in that 5 months, I blocked a great deal of it out. But if I think about it long enough, there's just certain pieces of it that I remember. And I remember just horrible things happening to me as a 15-year-old that I should have never had to live through. I got back to Hawaii. I actually called my dad, which I realized by the time I got into foster care that he wasn't my biological dad. But I did call him and I was like, can I get a plane ticket? I need to come home. I'm doing a lot of drugs and I'm really in a bad place. Not really explaining to him what was actually going on. But because I didn't have any therapy during the time that I was in foster care, I went back to him and he was an abuser in my life. That is one of the weirdest things to me is that I would actually have called him. And so I got back into foster care. I ended up graduating high school, but I didn't ever have any therapy. I would dip back into the game and I would like flip-flop back and forth. I'd have terrible relationships that usually ended up in a TRO against a guy. And I just look at my own self, like I was so angry and I was like a time bomb all the time. Like I would pop off all the time about little things. Like normal people don't get mad about stuff like that. And I would just be like viciously angry. So I dipped back in the game when I was about 30 and my friend was like, God, girl, you're gonna like somebody's gonna kill you or you're gonna kill somebody. Like your life is so crazy. And mind you, I was working a square job. So I worked in a law office and during the days and then at night I'd work in a strip club. So it was very much of a mask. And I learned how to use that mask from a very young age. In the work that I get to do today is that I can see through the masks of many of our victims and survivors.
I'll bet. As you share that part of your story, although you received, you know, therapy, they say, it didn't sound like it was really therapy the way you're describing it. And it really missed some very essential pieces, which I know Ola Napua really brings in to helping these young people understand really what they're in. It sounds like part of it is you may not have fully known what you were really involved with and the depth of what this was. Is that the case?
Absolutely. And that is what drives me to do the work today.
I'll bet.
Is because when I met Jessica, her team was talking about sex trafficking. And I was like, well, what is sex trafficking? What is that? We didn't have that language, of course, when I was trafficked, right? And so when I heard it, I still didn't really recognize my victimization until I heard another survivor speak. And then I was like, holy moly, this happened to me. This happened to me.
Really was a mask you were wearing. There's a past you're saying that no one had identified. Even you're saying, I didn't know what I didn't know about what I was in and kind of my own identity.
Yeah, I went to this conference and heard about sex trafficking. And then we went to some trainings in California. And I heard another survivor speak and I identified with that survivor. I was a victim of sex trafficking. And I told the rest of the team that. And they're like, what are you talking about? Because I did not exhibit any of these triggers, trauma, behaviors, because I had gone through 10 years of healing at that point. And so I was no longer wearing a mask. I was no longer pretending to be somebody. I was who I authentically was, like who God created me to be. I was walking in it and I was living it and I was thriving. I was married. Right. I mean, like that to me, that is like the biggest deal because like when I came out of the game, I was like, I am never marrying a man. I am never getting married.
But then trust them.
But No, but then what happened is because I didn't have I had a trafficker for 5 months. Now we have to remember, buyers exploit women. Mm-hmm. Buyers abuse women.
That's right.
Buyers abuse children.
Yeah.
So let's not only look at the trafficker. We must look at the buyers. I hated every trick I ever had. There was
really
not
the
one
consumer
trick.
Is the one you're pointing to right now.
There was That's not right. one trick that I liked. And so I was like, I'm never getting married. But then, of course, you get healed. Like, I was in a really sweet place in my life. And then I swore Jessica to secrecy. I said, don't you ever tell anybody that I was trafficked. I will do fundraising for you. I'll keep the books for the organization. I'll do whatever you guys want me to do. But don't you ever tell anybody that I was trafficked, because I am not that girl. And then as we would do work together, we would be at an engagement. We would be speaking. Jessica would be telling people about how girls get trafficked in Hawaii. And then I would just see them not believing her. And I was like, wait a minute. We must tell the real experience of a real survivor from Hawaii. And so that's when I started talking about it.
So you took some risks.
Yeah, you know, I'm still learning, as a matter of fact, because it's lifelong. Like, the healing process never stops. At 15 years old, my voice was silenced. I did not tell anybody because I was so ashamed. I didn't receive the amount of therapy that I probably should have. I did not have a mentor to walk me through life. Like, that is so important. You that bet. We as survivor leaders in our community walk you alongside bet. Of these victims and you let bet. The world know that there is no shame in their game, that this is something that happened to them. They Agreed. Are children. They had no consent to what no. was done to them. I no. do not care if they tell you, mm-hmm. that is my boyfriend, that is my man, I wanted to. We know we're done with that conversation, because okay. you are a child. Your boyfriend was 35 years old. Mm-hmm. He should not have put you on the block. He should That's not right. have traded you for a bag of weed. Like, yeah. I don't care. You did not need to go sell yourself to make his car payment. Right. No, I don't care what he tells you. Housing is a big deal. I know a lot of our young people, they will trade their body for a place to stay. Yep. That's trafficking. Job training, if they have the only option is to sell their body in order to buy groceries, like, what options are we really giving our young people? Yeah. Family support, like, helping families to not be ashamed of their kids. Yeah. Like, that happened to your child. Well, maybe we need to look at the family dynamic as well, because if you did not allow your brother, your cousin, your uncle, your grandpa, your sister, your brother, mother, whoever is the abuser, to abuse that child in the first place, that Yes. child may not have run away from home. So Amen. We have to take an account. Like, we need to really look at ourselves as family and say, we need to be responsible. These are children that we're talking about. Yeah. Empowering our families to walk alongside of these children as well.
I'm really appreciating kind of what you're pulling together right now. And I appreciate your story. And I appreciate your willingness to kind of be selfless and sharing that with us, because I know that's going to speak to somebody, whether on the family side or a practitioner side, or maybe someone listening to this show, that they themselves are in this. And maybe like you, they're going, wait a minute, that's my story right there. But I never really knew that that was my story that I was actually in once upon a time, where I'm living right now. So I appreciate your transparency and just, again, that selfless piece. What you're also highlighting here too is a little bit what you're doing in your program that is so necessary that you didn't get. Things like having somebody walk alongside you, someone who's able to raise awareness and education, somebody who provides you a safe place to stay, somebody who gives you the right kind of therapy so you can learn and understand what you're in, and through that education become empowered and begin to make some steps and some really informed decisions. And maybe, Jessica, I could kind of segue with you a little bit to now talk a little bit about the program Ola Napua and how you guys are coming alongside these children. I'd just love to hear more about your advocacy, your awareness building, prevention, interventions. Share that with us, please, would you?
So when we first started doing this work, we looked for where gaps in care existed, because, you know, I'm not into recreating the wheel or duplicating services that are already yeah. there. But what we found, there was a few significant gaps. So the first one being crisis intervention and advocacy. So Tammy says it so well, but these kids and our young adults need 24/7, 365. You know, trafficking and that trauma from trafficking doesn't take a break at 5 o'clock and on the weekends. So we learned we need to be available all the time. So we developed a 24/7 crisis line. With that, we've been able to talk to many different survivors and family members that might be concerned about someone. So we've been able to fill that gap. We developed a mentoring program where we work one-on-one with youth and young adults who've been trafficked. You know, the Harvard School of Child Development says that as long as there is one healthy, safe adult in a child's life, their outcome is better when they've gone through trauma. And so we developed an intensive mentoring program where we've trained up and vetted some amazing volunteer mentors who come from a variety of backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And the thing that our youth will say is, wow, you're not paid to be here to spend time with me. You're not paid time with me.
Yeah.
Yeah, very genuine. And we ask for a year commitment from our mentors, but oftentimes it turns into 4 years, as Tammy says. We deliver babies, we do Tammy weddings.
Tammy's got six fingers up right there. That's a long standing. That's right.
Yeah, Tammy.
We do life together.
Like, yes, and you know, Tammy will get people reaching out to her on social media who she might not have talked to for years, who maybe they weren't ready to get help, and then now all of a sudden they are. So we always, in every encounter we get with youth and young adults, we say, we're here, we're committed. So we're always here for you. And they sometimes go on the run. They sometimes, you know, go MIA for a little bit, but then they seem to come back.
Yep. You're always there.
And so that mentoring piece has been huge. Yeah. So one of the things we also identified is that, you know, we don't have a comprehensive residential treatment center here in Hawaii. So we are in the process of building Pearl Haven, which is Hawaii's first residential treatment center for kids who've been trafficked. And so nationally, there's less than 600 residential treatment beds for kids who have been trafficked. So we're building a pretty significantly sized residential treatment program for girls 11 to 18, and it will provide them a year-long residential program here in Hawaii. So as long as they're under the age of 18, they'll be eligible to receive this level of care.
Just real quick, that Tim was saying earlier, if we don't have housing, that's something that is just, you know, Maslow's basics, you know, food, shelter, clothing.
Totally.
Just put those in place. We can't do anything else, even therapy.
Yeah.
Until we have those things in place. So this housing program is essential.
And I think it's even deeper than housing, because right now there's shelters and there's housing for kids that's temporary, but they're not getting the intensive treatment. If you don't start unpacking those layers and layers of trauma, you're really only dealing with the symptoms and the surface. And so we've developed a model that deals with the root of trauma. And so it actually has little to do with the trafficking component and more what led to this, right? And it's often dealing with that sexual abuse as a child and their value, worth, identity. So we're really excited because that program should be opening in the first quarter of next year.
Right.
So we've been developing out this beautiful facility. But what we found is with the short-term placements, either in youth shelters or youth corrections or detention, we then built a program that goes into all of those settings now, and it's called HOKU, and it's a group mentoring resiliency program. So it focuses on their uniqueness, identity, attachment. We spend 2 hours a week in each facility. We work with over 100 plus kids a week between Oahu and Hawaii Island. We're in two different programs over there. And so with that, we've also been able to work with a lot of high-risk kids who haven't been identified as trafficked. We suspect that they've been trafficked or exploited, but we've been able to connect with these kids who often then bounce to multiple other placements, and yet our program is consistent and still there. Nice. So it's something that was very much organic. It came from us having a conversation with Hawaii Youth Corrections Facility Warden, who was like, I need more programming for my girls that are just sitting around here all day. Yeah. And so we developed a program, and then it just blossomed and grew.
Fantastic.
And so we do art, we do songs, we do poetry, we talk about their bodies and nutrition. And so it's just a great way to build relationship. And through that, Tammy can attest to, it has allowed these girls to start understanding who we are and who we serve. And that's where we then start getting the reach out from them, especially when they leave facilities, like, hey, I think you came into the facility I was at. Can I talk to you? Yeah. And so it's just a big network that we're creating in this safety net.
So within the HOKU program, that is a lot of the times we get our referrals to our mentoring program and our advocacy program. So what happens sometimes with our kids is that they see they're actually getting somewhere and somebody's actually listening to them. Yeah. And so then they'll be like, yeah, I do want a mentor. Yeah, I do want somebody to walk with me. But you know what? I really want somebody who actually went through the things that I went through that will understand me. And therefore we can tailor their mentor to, you know, somebody who's been in the foster care system, actually somebody who's been trafficked. We have other survivors that are either on their way to be mentors or they're in our advocacy work.
Really feeling like it kind of takes one to know one in some areas, doesn't it?
Yeah, sometimes. And then that's really
sometimes.
The advocacy is also a bridge to the mentoring, because once, you know, once we get to a certain place of them trusting us in the advocacy program, then I will say, hey, are you ready for a mentor now? It does take time. It's taken me, you know, 3 to 6 months to develop that relationship in order for them to say, yeah, I do actually want a mentor. The mentors are more regular weekly visits and activity based. And advocacy is more on a crisis level, like we're in crisis and we need help right now. And then you change, you know, as the years go by. I say years because it's literally years. I also wanted to emphasize that when doing the See It tool, oftentimes our children don't recognize the fact that they have been victimized the way that I did, right? Not being able to recognize their own victimization.
The other big programming that we do is prevention. So we do talk to kids in schools from sixth grade to senior in high school about risk and what it looks like to be approached. And we do a lot of professional trainings for therapists, social workers, law enforcement, and community members, because, you know, most people don't really understand what this looks like. So we're helping to try to establish a statewide screening protocol, because oftentimes these kids are being misidentified and not recognized. And in Hawaii, our youth are being trafficked around the age of 11. And so we're not oftentimes seeing them or catching it till they're 14 or 17. Okay. So we're not catching it early enough. So there's a screening tool called the CSE-IT, and it's based out of the West Coast Children's Clinic. And I would encourage any therapist who's listening to look into it. It's not a diagnostic tool, but it screens for high risk.
Good.
And it's definitely something that I would suggest people look into, because you might not realize the client that you're serving right now could actually be being trafficked and exploited.
That's really good. I'm excited that in these series we have, we're going to be coming back in the third series talking a little bit more about some of the clinical aspects. I'm very excited about that, some of which you're already pointing us towards down the road, which will be a lot of fun and really kind of raise even a greater awareness. I know as we wind down on our time today, I'd love to leave our listeners with some information, some resources. So if I'm in danger or I need help or I know somebody who does need help, what are some good first steps for me?
So as clinicians, any clinicians listening nationally, you are a mandated reporter for kids under the age of 18 that you suspect are in a situation of exploitation. Mm-hmm. So you can call your local police. Obviously, if someone is in acute danger, it's 911. But you can also report to the National Human Trafficking Hotline, who then connects with local entities, law enforcement, and service providers. And they look into every tip that comes in. The National Human Trafficking Hotline is 888-373-7888. 888-373-7888.
Right.
If you are in Hawaii and you're looking for help, our 24/7 helpline is 808-435-9555. 808-435-9555.
Fantastic. What I love about what you were saying earlier, Jessica, too, I know we're kind of winding down, but you know, that Harvard study, it takes one person in our life that we call them kind of referred to as a good enough other. That's all it needs to be, just good enough other. And we know that relationships can really mess us up and get us away, you know, from the align that our design is meant to be and the life that we're created and given to live. And our lives are robbed from us sometimes by those around us, but it can take one person to bring us back in line with our design. and that one healing relationship that just walks alongside us, doesn't push us, doesn't require things of us, just loves us. And in that environment of love, we begin to discover and emerge into who we really are. And so I love the idea that we, you know, get to walk with each other, come alongside each other in a time like this, particularly around traumas. So well done, guys. Well, I'm so looking forward to coming back. You know, as looking up your name, the Hawaiian name, Ho'olanapua, means, like you said earlier, Jessica, new life for our children. Ola means healing and new life. Pua means flower and is also often a term that we use here in Hawaii when we talk about our children in an endearing way. And what I've so appreciated in my 35 years in being here is we don't typically choose our name. I've got three children and their names were chosen for them, their middle names, actually, for your program. Your name was blessed and given by a local kumu, which we refer to as teacher. And this name so richly and culturally reflects your mission and identifies with and reflects your Hawaiian culture and values. And this is social heritage that you folks are really promoting here through your program. So I so appreciate you both being here with us today. I look forward to our next two segments. And thank you for today's time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank Great you so much. The pua also creates a lei.
Yeah, it does.
Goes our community. So
I love that. I love that.
Yeah, we love it too.
Yeah. And to our listeners, I want to thank you for joining us as well. We look forward to having you back for our second segment. And thanks for listening to Behavioral Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community. And if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tried Behavioral Health Network, all rights reserved.